there, folks. Welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast, the podcast all about why being alive is more interesting than people think it is. My name is Alex Schmidt. I'm also known as Schmitty the Clam. I'm also known as Schmitty the Champ. And I am also going to play you the song of my youth. So if you know that weird robot duck noise, you lived through the era we're exploring today. Our topic today is Weird Ways the 1990s Never Ended. One more time, that is Weird Ways the 1990s Never Ended. Because hey, one way being alive is more interesting than people think it is that we are still living in the 1990s in a lot of ways. And we're taking that in a big picture way. Like, it's not that Beanie Babies are still popular or something. I'm talking about big societal things, big cultural norms that are somehow still with us. And I think that's fascinating for everybody, whether you lived through a time when you had to tie up the phone line with a 56K modem that sounded like that, or whether you are a teenager who is mystified by everything I just said. Either way, the 1990s are weirdly important to how life works today. And I've got the perfect guests for talking about that because they make an entire show about that every week on the Unpopular Opinion Podcast Network. I am joined by two comedians/podcasters. They are Adam Todd Brown, longtime Cracked person, you've heard him on the show many times, and a new guest to this show, Chet Wild. They make a weekly podcast entitled The 90s Sucked. Also, I feel that title is a little tongue-in-cheek because you have to know and care about the 1990s to address why they sucked, right? You also have to like them. And so the three of us are bringing together a range of experiences from that decade to explore how they are weirdly important to right now. It's going to touch on culture, politics, the environment, especially the first thing we're going to talk about, and so much more. So let's get into those 1990s things. Please sit back or push off of Brian Russell without them calling it so you can make a jumper to repeat the three-peat. Still love you, MJ. And either way, here's this episode of the Cracked Podcast with Adam Todd Brown and Chet Wild. I'll be back after we wrap up. Talk to you then. It has been a little bit of time since the 1990s. I realized that as we were putting this together. That was 20 years ago.
It's a long time ago.
I feel old.
And depending on which year you're talking about, it might have been 30 years ago.
I feel real old now. Yikes. Class of 2020 just graduated. I was class of 2002, and that feels forever ago.
Not to get all STEM on the podcast, but 2020 minus 1990, that's 30 years.
Don't be bringing your conspiracy theories on this podcast, Adam.
Sorry.
For those that don't listen to Adam and Maya's podcast, The 90s Suck, Adam thinks the 90s suck, but I think they're right.
And you guys on your show, you've gotten into so many ways that not only were the 90s something that sucked, or maybe were just okay, but I think the first thing we've got here is the AOL CD, which I feel like teens or whoever need some setup on, not just what AOL CDs were, but that like the mail was important, right? Like, we get mail today, but in the 90s, it was an event. Like, oh, the mail has come. A bunch of important messages.
I would get off the school bus and be excited to check the mail.
Yeah.
And I was just a kid.
Every time I would get one of those AOL CDs, my immediate thought was like, score. I'm going to use this someday. And I never once in my entire life put one of those CDs into a computer.
Oh, I used them all the time, and we would use our 50 free hours. Oh, here's a mind-blowing concept for the kids. Back then, the internet could be measured in time.
Yes.
Like, prior to the CDs, there was a thing called floppy disks. There were 3.5-inch floppy disks, which came after the 5.25-inch. And those originally, you would only get 10 or 15 hours of free AOL.
Yeah, the first internet service provider I had, you got 15 hours a month, and then it got insanely expensive if you went over your 15 hours.
It's kind of like, if you're younger, maybe you can relate to the early 2000s when text messages used to cost money.
Yeah.
Like, you get 50 texts a month, and then after that, it's 10 cents a text.
Can you imagine how much better the world would be if we all only spent 15 hours on the internet every month?
Even every week would be a step in the right direction.
That would be a revolution in this country.
For some people, 15 hours a day still might be cutting back.
Yeah.
Especially during COVID.
It is, like, remarkable, especially during COVID when everyone's just, like, online all the time. Like, every website's traffic is up during this. It is remarkable to think of the internet as something you would, like, ration out by time. It would take up the phone line for a lot of people. You had to, like, do a very noisy modem to get on. But then also there are these AOL CDs that it seems like they were kind of designed to get people onto the internet at all. Like, you guys talk about how the name America Online was, like, amazing branding. Because there was just this idea, like, at last we must put Americans on the internet at all.
Yes. I'm America. I deserve to be online.
Yeah.
Yeah, those CDs were such a massive undertaking. I hadn't, like, until we researched that episode, I had some concept that they were around all the time and had to have, like, gone somewhere, and that someone had to be producing these things. Like, they weren't just happening out of thin air, but I didn't realize the magnitude of the production that went into these. And, like, they put these CDs in Omaha Steaks. Like, these CDs were everywhere.
The magazine, not the actual steaks.
No, they packaged these discs. They talk about, there was a really interesting Quora thread. They, one of the things they talk about in this Quora thread, which was with all of these AOL executives from back when these discs were going out, was one of their biggest challenges was they wanted to put them in boxes of Omaha Steaks, which Omaha Steak is like a mail order steak company, which has always seemed weird to me. You can just go get steak. And they had to figure out how to put these. I mean, they didn't have to, but once Omaha Steaks said they wanted to partner with them, they had to, like, figure out, are these even going to survive if we mail them in those conditions? And they did. And they put them in everything. If you were at Blockbuster, where you would go rent movies like a fucking Neanderthal, like, you would get a free AOL disc with every movie you rented. It was nuts.
Apparently, they manufactured more than 1 billion AOL CDs and mailed them out. And, like the population of America is far less than a billion. Like, I think we're around a third of a billion right now. And they sent out all of these CDs just trying to convert people into AOL internet users, but with like, physical objects.
In my house alone, we must have had at least 20 CDs at one point. We would keep getting the free hours and then canceling our account and then spinning up a new account with a new screen name each time. And that was something that was seemingly radically different for the time. Back then, you wouldn't use your name on the internet. You would come up with a screen name. You wouldn't make your screen name, I'm Alex Schmidt. It was probably like Clammy Guy, Snoopy27 or something.
Who told you? Who told you my name? Clammy Guy, Snoopy27.
There was a difference between AOL and the internet. Like, AOL gave you internet access, but you remember there were AOL websites and real websites? Like, AOL is a program you would launch and the internet existed within it. Like, if you went to WWF.com at the time, or the WWF AOL website, two different websites.
Like, the AOL one was like an app or something within AOL's app.
Yeah, like, they were trying to be their own brand of internet.
It's not a lot unlike what Facebook is doing now. Like, that's kind of Facebook's thing is, well, let's take the entire internet and consolidate it in one website that fucking sucks. And, like, AOL didn't suck at the time. It was, like, very advanced for what it was. But we eventually came to learn, like, oh, we don't need a shell around this. We can just get on the internet. We don't need that AOL flag with it. But Facebook, it seems like, is trying to bring that back. If you look into their initiatives to, like, spread internet access throughout the world, they're not great. I mean, it's great that poor people have internet access. It's just not great that they're getting it from Facebook. So, yeah, Facebook is kind of trying to be the AOL of 2020.
with all the things we're looking at today, it's stuff that is from the 90s and somehow kind of never ended. And one is the physical waste of more than a billion AOL CDs. And then another is the idea of like a tech company trying to be the entire internet for people and like the entire way that the whole country uses it. Because, you know, that's lucrative. A lot of money in that.
Yeah. There's even a lot of money in the CDs now. If you can find them, there are people out there who collect these things like a bunch of damn weirdos.
Are there people still cashing in on these in terms of like just haven't paid for internet in 30 years? They're like, I need to find another 50 hours. I'm not paying for this shit.
I hope so. There were some really cool ones though, because they, if you look into the people who collect these, like there's one that was, I forget what it was released with, but it's like this really great painting of Magic Johnson. And it's like one of the rarest AOL discs. And it just, it looks like a piece of art. It's really neat. There's a Spider-Man one that's really rare that people go after. Like these discs were everywhere. They were basically advertising. Like it was just another way for a company to slip a little more advertising in. And you got 50 hours of free internet out of it.
Yeah, Americans love free shit.
Yeah.
They do.
We're the best.
It got to a point some of them would have like built-in free trial services for other like encyclopedia programs. Remember before the internet was that fast, you would buy an encyclopedia and it was like 10 discs yeah. And you would have it on your computer and like disc one would be A through D and then you're like, I want to look up frogs. Whoop, better open up my CD drive and put in F.
Yeah, I never understood the hate for Wikipedia. When Wikipedia was first becoming a thing, people would always complain about how anyone could edit Wikipedia. And it's like, oh, you'd prefer the system where like a room full of crusty old white men would just edit this book that you would get and that's the definitive source of information? Like, no, open that up to everybody. It's fine.
Yeah, especially like the World Book days when you had like a set of 10 encyclopedias that cost like 20 trees to make. Like, no, Wikipedia is maybe a better way to go.
Yeah, and I totally trust this dude from the University of Texas to be honest about Venezuela and world events.
These CDs they did, you guys found that AOL had to spend $35 per customer with the direct mail CD strategy, and then they tended to earn an average of $350 per customer in like eventual internet service. So this was a massively successful direct mail campaign. And then also you guys found a story about AOL kind of taking over compact disc production. AOL took it over like worldwide for a while. It's crazy.
For two solid weeks when AOL 4.0 launched, they needed so many discs to launch that they took over all CD production worldwide for 2 weeks.
For 2 weeks.
So for 2 weeks in, it was either 97 or 98, there were no Celine Dion CDs. There were no Backstreet Boys CDs. It was just all AOL discs.
Could we elect 1996 to 97 AOL to be president just for like 2 weeks? They would know how to shut shit down and just make PPE for 2 weeks, and we'd be golden.
Not the worst idea.
You can't tell me that 25 years ago, we could shut an entire industry down to make one thing, and now we can't figure that out today.
Yeah, AOL had no legal power, and they were able to do that. Like, they have no authority at all. They just organized it.
Yeah, it's insane to think about. By that point, CDs were the way people listened to music. At that point in history, 1997, 98, that is prime CD territory. So to be able to take over that kind of production for 2 weeks, that is intense power.
CDs were so popular, that's how you had people like Garth Brooks out doing the Beatles on sales records, because just everybody was buying CDs of everything. They had no problem with it. And you also found, Adam, some interesting stuff about like CD pricing being an interesting thing that companies manipulated, because like CDs were the currency for everything.
The five CD companies or five music companies were basically convicted of price fixing between the years of 1995 and 2000. It's a really complicated thing because on the one hand, yes, they did kind of put a chokehold on places like Best Buy that were selling CDs for like $5.99 and crazy prices like that. And they did kind of limit their ability to do that, but they also, everything those retailers were doing was gutting independent record stores. And what the music industry did was at least intended to kind of help fix that problem. It didn't fix that problem. And most independent record stores went away. But it's a real gray area where on the one hand you can kind of see why they were convicted, but on the other, maybe they were trying to do a good thing. Probably not. Like I doubt their only motive was to help independent record stores, but they were trying to, at least.
Yeah, and with CDs being all of music, also all of computer gaming, especially. Like, I had tons of CDs with games on them, and then AOL sending a billion of them to Americans. They're just this, like, massive environmental thing that we just sort of have with us from the 90s still. Like, now we download so many things. It's a different cost because it's servers. But the thing with CDs is they are made of layered polycarbonate and aluminum. And I don't totally understand that, but I know it makes them hard to recycle. And so CDs just became a thing that filled up our landfills because also a lot of them tended to be made pretty cheaply, so they warp easily and scratch easily, and then you just have like a disc of trash and you just throw it straight in the garbage.
Yeah, the problem is we were lied to about CDs. When CDs came out, they were like, they're not going to get scratched like records and they'll last forever. And it's like, yeah, they last forever if you never touch them and never put them in a CD player. Like, CDs were kind of a scam. Like, we were buying them under the belief that, well, this is going to be your permanent music collection and you're going to own this stuff forever. And no one has CDs anymore.
Especially even the name compact disc. I know they're saying it's more compact than like vinyl, but I feel like even that name probably implied to people like, oh, it'll just be a little disc, like it's a little buddy. There won't be any hassle to America's landfills in the future. But no, they're full of probably literally billions of them.
What's interesting about the environmental thing to me, though, is even with CDs filling up landfills and whatnot, it's not that much better than streaming music.
Yeah.
Like, music files don't grow naturally out of the ground. They are stored on things that are using energy. And when you really get down to it, like we talked on a Cracked podcast about movie theaters and how
Right. Going
to the movies, you would think like staying home and streaming a movie is just significantly better, but it's just marginally better for the environment than going to a movie theater. And CDs, as bad as they were, they're just marginally worse than streaming services.
It's kind of like how people buy electric cars and think they have clean energy, but don't really account for, well, if the electricity is coming from a coal factory,
right,
if your batteries are made of rare earth mineral, whatever the fuck they are, like, you're just an asshole. You're just an asshole pretending to be doing good things.
Another episode you guys have done is about another way that the 90s have not really ended yet, which is that in the 90s, there started to be websites like stormfront.org. And that website is not related to the weather. It is related to white nationalism. And that's a thing that is quite popular on the internet to this day.
Very popular. And the internet was supposed to eliminate all that. Like, if you can believe it, there was a point where the people who launched the internet and the people who were responsible for making it like this commercially available thing, they had it in their adorable little liberal brains that once,
well-intentioned,
that once the world had access to all the information, hate would just go away. Like, once every white nationalist just read the right Wikipedia article about how black people really are, then we would just all start getting along. And oh man, were they so wrong.
Yeah.
Like, it was just the exact opposite right away. People were like, oh my God, I have a platform to spread my hate, finally.
Oh my God, there are others that hate like me? Let's get together.
Yeah, it really had the opposite effect of what we thought it was going to do.
Yeah, because I remember feeling like, oh, with the internet, I can finally connect with my fellow fans of Star Trek The Next Generation. And then, like, oh, there were other people connecting with fans of other stuff at the same time. That was obviously what was going on.
I mean, it's almost debatable as to whether that was better. I feel like we would have been better off if the internet stopped progressing at, like, message boards. Like, when we at least still had to all go to our separate rooms to talk about whatever bullshit, be it white nationalism or, for me, Oasis. Like, sure. You still had to go,
you know, whatever,
to a separate
topic.
Place.
Yeah,
yeah. I still had to go hide in this corner of the internet to talk about loving Oasis in 1999. And I feel like that was kind of better. Because what we did instead of keeping that is social media became a thing, and then everyone's ideas and thoughts were all centralized in one place, and we eventually realized that some of those thoughts don't really have value in a public space, so we were like, get off Facebook, go back to your little corners of the internet. When, like, that whole process just kind of radicalizes those people a little more. Because now, like, they feel like their ideas really are a threat. Maybe they are onto something. And this is why the man's shutting them down. But if they were just all still in their own message board from 2003, we wouldn't even notice.
With that, I think internet speeds got too fast. Like, streaming shows is great, but we have way too much access to way too much, if you want to call it information, in our feeds every day. And I think there's something to having to wait for a page to load and only being able to scroll and consume so much that causes you to slow down and you're able to cherry pick less and have to actually thoroughly consume what you're looking at.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with that, because it slower internet would also limit your ability to research the things you read. Like, that's kind of what you have to do with news articles these days, is sort of dig into their sources and, you know, find where they're getting their information from. And that's a whole lot harder if you have slow internet. I kind of feel like that's what's really behind all of this talk about negative health risks of 5G internet and things. I feel like we're just really, as a country, not in a rush to increase people's access to information. Like, that is kind of how Republicans keep control in a lot of ways, because when you get out into rural areas, the access to internet is severely limited. So
my parents still have dial-up.
Yeah, so, like, you can't go to a glitzy CNN website that's got all these flash videos and whatnot playing. Like, it's never going to load. But Stormfront, that still looks like it was built in 1997, if it's even still online. But, like, look at every conservative website. They're built to run on slow internet.
Or go to spacejam.com and look at the original promotional website for the movie Space Jam, which still exists in its original form from 1996. Yeah. If you're a little younger, that's what the fucking internet looked like in the mid-90s.
Yeah, mid-90s websites were, like, a collection of a couple really grainy GIF images, and I don't mean GIF where it's like an animated thing. I mean, like, the .gif file format for a still image where you just click on it and get to a couple more .gifs. It was crazy.
It was all pretty useless, and I think that's when the internet was at its best, when it was useless. Now it's far too useful for too many people.
I don't know if we could, like, solve it by slowing down the internet, but I love the idea of the YouTube-specific white nationalism problem going away. Like, it's way too easy to just load a video really fast on YouTube when you were in a K-hole of apparently following these people. I haven't done it. But, it, like, just the suggested next video will be another, racist. It's not good.
It's a debate in this country as to whether we should have, right from the outset, kind of treated the internet the way China does, where they're like, yeah, you can use it, but we're going to tell you how to use it. We didn't do that in this country. Like, pretty much immediately upon the internet becoming a thing everyone was using, we passed this thing called the Communications and Decency Act that put something in place called Section 230, which is such a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, it protects people who run websites from being prosecuted for the actions of their users. But on the other hand, it protects people who run websites from being prosecuted for the actions of their users. Like, it opens up this area where people can be like, I don't know, man, that's just the people on my website. I don't have anything to do with it. And it allowed a lot of things, a lot of really unfortunate things to spread. But now that they're sort of cracking down on it, it's like, we've had this freedom this long. I don't think we're going to give it back now. I mean, we will. They won't allow us to not give it back. But it feels like Section 230 is being attacked now, especially with stuff like SESTA FOSTA, which under the guise of stopping sex trafficking on websites like Backpage, it also kind of chipped away at Section 230 in that what they were basically saying was, if you're not doing enough to stop sex trafficking on your website, you can go to prison too, which sounds reasonable, but it's only reasonable until it gets applied to something else, like free speech. Like,
yeah,
I don't, as much of a problem as YouTube is, I don't necessarily think the people who created YouTube should be criminally prosecuted for white nationalist videos being on their website. Like, that is, that's a slippery slope. Like, it would feel good to us on the left at first, but then that's the kind of thing that can come for you next very easily.
And also, how do you, at that scale and volume, how do you manage to thoroughly check everything before it goes out? And then who gets to decide? It's just such a massive, unrealistic thing to take on.
Yeah.
And they try to develop AI to snoop some of that stuff out, but it's just, man.
And I think people don't know that, like, that AI attempt and SESTA FOSTA and, like, so many other things people are doing to try to, like, nibble away at how the internet works now, like, that entire foundation is from this one law in 1996. Like, the 90s created the very open internet where no U.S. internet company can be prosecuted for the actions of its users. Like, we're still living in that world designed by 1996 people.
And one unintended consequence in the review process, like, this has been covered pretty well by a number of news outlets at Facebook. You have the kind of low-paid review employees at Facebook, or they outsource to a third party, and a lot of those people are having PTSD or a lot of mental health issues or even suicidal, because if it's your job to sit through and see the worst of the worst on the internet for even a couple weeks, that's gonna fuck you up permanently.
It would be kind of like your job is to be an AI program. Like, you are a living, breathing, artificial intelligence program. And the way those things work is they get fed all the information. That's why every time we put an AI bot on Twitter, it turns racist in like 35 minutes.
Yeah.
Because you give it enough information and it's going to be like, oh, yeah, this is what the internet's like. Okay, fuck Jews. And it's like, slow down, robot. And, like, those people are seeing that. Like, they are the machines that shit is being fed to. And they're seeing, like, child abuse, fucking murders, like, so many crazy things when you're trying to police the internet in that way. And it's debatable about which of those two approaches is healthier. Like, do you just, you know, let it spread and kind of hope that the people who are into that kind of thing just go to their own corner of the internet? Or do you police it and subject a lot of living people to the absolute worst things humanity has to offer for 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week?
And that openness in terms of content and lack of responsibility for the companies, like, it, among other things, starting in the 90s, it seems like it supported these white nationalist websites. Like, why were white nationalists so fast to get on the internet in that decade? What led them to make that leap and build their spacejam.coms, but for evil?
They're tech savvy as fuck.
Yeah, that's the thing. It was an oversight on the part of the people who created the internet in that they didn't take into account that, historically speaking, fascists are really quick to adopt new technology because anything they can use to spread their message more, they're going to use it. And the minute the internet went online, the first thing white nationalists did was go, how can we use this to spread our message? And because the internet was such a freewheeling place when it went online, there was literally nothing we could do about it.
This past week had a guest on, her name's Nicole Hemmer, and she's a historian who does a lot of stuff on just conservative media, especially in the 20th century, and they were like right away on mass radio and TV from there. Like, they were like, oh, as soon as that is a thing that's super useful, we're going to start broadcasting there, like, as much as we can. Yeah. Because that's what they do.
Yeah, that's what they
do. And I guess maybe the problem with white nationalism on the internet today is that the internet is still the cutting edge, right? Like, just as soon as there's new apps and new services and new ways we can use it, they will be there. And then when there's not, maybe that's when they leave. I don't know.
They have certainly taken to social media, that's for sure.
Yeah, how about that? They love it. Another 90s thing that is oddly still with us, you guys have done episodes on the Waco standoff and the Ruby Ridge standoff, which those have both ended as events, but that's a behavior that's still going on in the world.
Those events happened when the internet was sort of in its infancy in terms of the internet we know now. And
yeah, pre-Space Jam.
Right, when Jordan was spreading white nationalist stuff with Bugs Bunny on the space. Is that what happened in that? I don't remember. But
yeah. Why do you think he played for the White Sox?
Explains that mustache in the Hanes commercial, that's for sure.
All right, I'm turning off the show if the White Sox are going to be denigrated as...
I'm just saying, that's the baseball team he played for.
It's true. And for dates real quick, Ruby Ridge was August of 1992 in the northern tip of Idaho, and then Waco was February through April of 1993. So within less than a year, we have these two events taking over, like, the whole country's attention.
Right, and that's the same general time when white nationalists started really picking up on using the internet and using it to spread their message. And at the exact same time that's happening, Ruby Ridge and Waco happens. What people I don't think understand about especially Ruby Ridge and Waco both is those groups, part of their core belief, whether they were white nationalists or not, Branch Davidians were not white nationalists. Randy Weaver, who was the subject of the Ruby Ridge standoff, was definitely sympathetic to the Aryan Nation, but he wasn't a member of the Aryan Nation. And the thing about all of those groups, whether they're white nationalist groups or not, one of their core beliefs is that, all right, well, here's how the end times are going to start. We're going to collect a bunch of guns, and then the government's going to come try and take those guns. And when that happens, the end times have started. So at Ruby Ridge and Waco both, what we essentially did was give white nationalists a rallying point where they could go, see, everything we've said was going to happen just happened. And in both cases, we very much could have handled it in a way that didn't result in that. And that's why if you look into Ruby Ridge and Waco both, like, the media kind of sold it as one thing, but they're both to some degree government atrocities that are both instances of the government way overstepping their bounds in the enforcement of laws. And what Waco and Ruby Ridge did, it gave all those right-wing types who were online early something to talk about and something to get in message boards and rally around. And it kind of directly resulted in the Oklahoma City bombing, which happened, I believe, on the anniversary of Waco. And like Timothy McVeigh, when he was interviewed after his arrest, he pointed to Waco as kind of the inspiration for the Oklahoma City bombing. You can't really unring that bell, but I would be interested to see how different the world would be right now if we handled Waco and Ruby Ridge differently. Because yeah, it really did kick off a lot of bad things in this country.
Because also, I think I knew of Waco as being cult-related. It's the Branch Davidians and David Koresh, like, under siege from the government. And then Ruby Ridge is, like, one family besieged by the government. But I think people forget how much of a gun element there is. Like, especially in the Obama years, we would laugh at, like, oh, these gun owners think Obama is coming for their guns. Ha ha ha. And he wasn't. But also, like, there was a event where the government came for guns in the 90s, like, twice. And that's where they got this crazy idea. Like, there's a specific situation.
Yeah, and if you look into the Branch Davidians, they did indeed have a lot of guns and sold a lot of guns. But also, they were in Texas. Everybody had a lot of guns. Everybody was selling guns. And they sold their guns legally. Like, when I say legally, it's not in the way I would prefer guns be sold in this country, mm-hmm. but laws are laws, and they weren't actually breaking any laws. A lot of the gun stuff that prompted us to crack down on Waco is based on, like, someone reported hearing gunshots that sounded like automatic weapons, so we were like, oh, okay, we better send all of the FBI to that building and burn it to the ground. There's a Waco TV series right now that gets a lot of criticism for being very sympathetic to the Branch Davidians, and that's valid criticism in a lot of cases, but the way they portray the government's response to Waco, I think, is pretty accurate. And if not accurate, it's the way it needs to be told, because it was... How do you justify, oh, well, we need to protect these kids that are being abused inside this compound. How about we fire tear gas that was banned under the Geneva Convention into the room and see if that helps? It's like, you're not protecting kids when you do that. Those kids were still in the building. It was obviously something else that brought us there.
Kids cry enough already. We don't need to add tear gas into the mix.
Right?
I feel like when I think about conspiracy theories, or when we talk about them on this show, there's often a thing where there just aren't that many conspiracy theories. Like, there's a couple of them and they get repeated pretty heavily. And one of them is this, like, especially 90s thing of, like, oh, we need to assemble a cult and hold out against the government. And it's completely crazy. And then also you see, even in much more recent times, like in the 2010s with that Bundy family, where, like, they held out on their ranch in Nevada and then they seized a federal preserve in Oregon. The members of it will have links about it. The Bundys explicitly cited Waco and Ruby Ridge as, like, see, you still can't trust the government. Like, you need to have your guns. And the Bundys are more about, like, sovereign citizen, no one should pay taxes kind of thing. But it's the same thing of, like, you simply can't trust the government, because the siege in Waco killed dozens of people and other things like that.
Don't trust the government. Trust me, crazy person, holding guns and taking parts of Oregon hostage.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good fucking argument.
The Bundys are a weird, I mean, not weird, but they're an interesting case, because it takes us right back to the same question. Like, what do you do about people like this? Like, yeah. We've seen how it ends when you go in with guns blazing, like, not great, but you also can't do nothing, which it seems like is exactly what we're doing now when it comes to people like the Bundys.
Yeah, because if people don't know, like, the Ruby Ridge standoff ended in two members of the family, the Weaver family, and also their dog being killed, and also one U.S. Marshal was killed in this standoff. And then the Waco siege ends in 82 Branch Davidians, including 25 children, being killed. Four ATF agents are killed and 16 are wounded. And, like, with the Bundys, when they tried to hold out on their ranch in 2014 to not pay grazing fees, and tried to take over an Oregon wildlife refuge in 2016 because they said the Constitution doesn't let the government have land. Like, that didn't have those body counts. Like, maybe, I feel crazy saying it, maybe we learned something. Maybe we, like, learned a lesson and at minimum, you know, decreased the murder. That's pretty good.
You would hope. like, you mentioned Ruby Ridge and that two of his family members died. It's not just that. They shot his wife in the face while she was holding their baby. Mm. Like, that is so aggressive.
Yeah.
I would argue, not to go out on a limb by myself here, but yeah, they didn't even know it happened at first because they had a shoot on sight order for Randy Weaver. And when they saw Randy Weaver, they shot and they fucking missed and hit his wife in the face. Mm. And everyone ran back inside when that happened. So at one point, like 5 days later, the FBI or the ATF goes to negotiate with him. And they're like, hey, Randy, let us talk to your wife. And the way Randy Weaver took that was the government is taunting me because they know they killed my wife. And it was actually just that we didn't know that we shot his wife in the face, which, yeah, there were some procedural errors at Waco and Ruby Ridge. And I hope we have learned from them. Like, it doesn't, in saying that, I hope people at home realize doesn't mean you agree with what those people were doing or right. their ideas or the things they were pushing. You got to separate that out sometimes. Like, sometimes the government does bad things to bad people, and it's still not good.
Yeah, and could have been done better. Right. Well, also, we've got a few more things here, and one of them is another way the 1990s have not ended, which is Joe Biden, who is the presumptive Democratic nominee for president. You guys did a whole episode about the 1994 crime bill that he was so involved in that when Biden ran for president in 2008, his website called it the Biden crime bill. Like, he was very, very proud of this bill. And now today it has had some effects.
Yeah, it was directly responsible for minorities being incarcerated at a disproportionately higher rate than white people in the 90s. And it's, I don't want to go from Trump to someone like Biden with this kind of law and order background. It wasn't just that Joe Biden passed that crime bill. He is responsible for the law that put a higher sentence on crack possession convictions as opposed to powder cocaine, which you need powder cocaine to make crack. But for some reason, Joe Biden thought it would be a great idea if you're arrested with crack, you maybe get a life sentence. And if you get arrested with powder, well, then maybe you get like 4 or 5 years. And it's like, how would you not have the foresight to see how that's going to play out? Mm-hmm. Even separate from the ramifications of it, which were horrible, I just don't trust him to make good decisions. Like, he can spin that crime bill all he wants. It was possibly the biggest atrocity this government pulled off in the 90s. Way bigger than Ruby Ridge or Waco. And the things it led to, we aren't going to recover from. It's not just that we're still suffering from it. There are communities that are never going to recover from this, or at least families. Yeah. And it's just so inexcusable to me.
But what better platform than to say you created a bill that disproportionately puts people of color in jail over whites than to win over some of the Trump swing voters that are looking for another option?
Yeah, I mean, I know you're joking, but yeah.
I'm 80% joking, 20% like, if you framed it that way to some people that are like, Trump's full of shit. He didn't build the wall. Oh, this guy puts black people in jail? Yeah, he's pretty white and old, and I guess I could vote for him.
Maybe that speaks to Biden being a symptom of a wider thing where it's still the 1990s in politics in a lot of ways. And Obama distracted us from this by being newer and more progressive than that. But like, if you look at all of the other Democratic nominees around that, obviously Gore was coming out of the 90s, he's allowed. But then Kerry and Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, it's all just people who were basically like very 1990s or right after that senators and have a perspective there where there's a lot of like language where people are like, obviously this should be the nominee because they'll win over Clinton Democrats, which is the most 90s thing you can do.
Yeah, they're establishment Democrats. They've been in power for decades and things have always been one way. And even if they're not Trump, which automatically makes you a little more progressive. Yeah. It also doesn't mean every Democrat like wants to pay for your Medicare for all or wants to get rid of your student loan debt. There are rich Democrats also, and they do want to hang on to their money. They just want to do it in a way that doesn't make them look bad. And those are the people that need to be out of office also. When you look at this crime bill, what worries me about Biden as it pertains to the crime bill and the direction the country is going, if he wins, a lot of people are going to be very unhappy. And it could very well lead to a little bit of unrest in this country, not just from right-wing types who are angry that Trump is out of office, but also a lot of people on the left who saw this election as an opportunity to go in a more progressive direction. And what we got was fucking Joe Biden. If there is some level of unrest in this country, Biden caters to a demographic that would be fine with seeing white nationalists and socialists both getting fucking destroyed to restore the peace. Like, that's a centrist. That's a person who hears socialism and goes, oh no, that's like, isn't that what the Nazis did? And it's like, no, not really. Like, very, very different things, just a similar word. And not everyone's as smart as us. And a lot of people aren't able to think critically enough beyond, oh, well, I know socialism's bad and I know white nationalism is bad. How about we just cut out both of those things? And Joe Biden is absolutely the president who would do that. Like, he has that law and order background where if there's unrest in this country, you don't have to just think about how he's going to treat white nationalists if it happens. Think about how he's going to treat people on the left if it happens also. It's not going to be good for anyone, especially if we're basing it off his past when it comes to passing bills to fight crime. He's not good at it.
A silver lining here is that if Biden does win, he is likely to be a one-term president. And I believe, Alex, he pulled up some research that backs that up where he said, I don't have it in me for two terms.
It's an interesting thing where it seems like however this particular election goes, I'm optimistic that it's sort of the last election that can be dominated by 1990s politicians, just because of how the passage of time works, if nothing else. But like theoretically on Inauguration Day of 2025, Trump will be 78.5 years old, even if he wants to do a third term or a Grover Cleveland thing or something. And then Biden will be 83 in 2025. And there's a rumor from Politico that Biden has told staff and insider people that he doesn't want to run a second time. He'll just be too old. So either way, this 2021 is kind of like we pick one of these guys and then maybe we do like future stuff and like progressive stuff and try something new.
Which is why his vice presidential pick is so important, too, because if he wins, they'd be the likely successor or nominee.
Yeah. And he also, when he talked about being a transition candidate, part of that quote was that he's here to usher in the Mayor Pete's of the world. And it's like, cool transition from establishment Democrat to young establishment Democrat.
You know, when I think progressive and new, I think CIA. I don't know about you guys, but that's...
Exactly. And again, it's a thing that comes down to people being able to think a little more critically than I think a lot of people are, which when it comes to Mayor Pete, a lot of people will just see, oh, he's young and he's gay. That sounds progressive to me. Let's go in that direction. And it's like, don't forget he was in the CIA also.
I mean, not it's not proven, but Mayor Pete is fucking CIA.
He's also from Pence country, isn't he?
Yeah, Indiana.
Yeah, mayor of South Bend, which, oof, ever been to South Bend? Homes around Notre Dame are cheap for a reason.
Mayor Pete is very of a piece with Joe Biden where, like, in a sense he is progressive. Like, I feel like Biden is very progressive given that he, if he had never been vice president, would probably be our oldest and longest serving senator. Like, for being the most ancient senator, he's a pretty progressive guy. Biden won his first Senate race in 1972 when he was 29 years old. And you have to be 30 to be in the Senate, but he would like hit 30 by the time they'd swear him in. So he got to run and do it. and then was in the Senate just all the way until then. Like, not only is he establishment in, like, his kind of set of policies and worldview, but also he's just, like, been in the establishment a long time, like, just in terms of, like, hours logged, you know? So it's strange. It seems like a hard guy to pick for, like, a radical change to address, as you said, like, the massive problems we have right now. It's interesting.
Yeah, I don't think he's the guy to do it. Like, I don't see anything. There's nothing progressive about the way Joe Biden sniffs young girls' hair. Like, there's
yes.
the ways he, like, and, like, when stuff, like, the groping stuff came up, like, completely separate from the rape allegations, but, like, you would hear a lot of people be like, okay, well, he's just an old man who doesn't understand how we're dealing with women these days. And it's like, yep, that's the problem. That is exactly the problem. Yeah. Pull up any of the multiple videos of Joe Biden actually getting challenged on one of his platforms or ideas by a young person. It ends the exact same way every time, which is him saying, you should probably vote for Trump. And it's like, you know what? You shouldn't run against Trump if that's going to be your fucking answer. Like, I'm sorry. We are not at the point in history where not Trump is good enough. Like, right. We need more than that, or this country's going to explode.
He was VP for 8 years, so in a way, electing him feels like kind of a collective consciousness attempt of hitting reset on a game, like going back 3 levels to, like, oh, we'll go back to pre-Trump, and that's not really moving forward.
But Biden carries on, and as we said, this is probably his last election coming up. We'll see what happens. We also, before we go, we've got a couple other things here, and one of them is the idea that comedy turned into the news, specifically in the 90s. Like, a lot of the coverage of Biden and Trump and everything we're about to see in the election is going to be from comedy sources, I guess maybe including this podcast. But it was a phenomenon that became, like, an institution specifically in the 90s in a way that I don't think everybody is aware of.
Yeah, you had the premiere of Politically Correct in the early 90s, and then it went mainstream on ABC before Bill Maher eventually got fired for a 9/11 joke, and now it's on HBO.
Yeah.
You had the original Daily Show in 96 or 97, and then Jon Stewart took over in the late 90s. You started having news hosts hosting White House correspondence dinners, and you started seeing these comedic voices on panels on the cable news channels. And I think lines started to get blurred. And I'm guilty of this as well. Like, I, back then and even now to an extent, get some of my political news from these comedy shows.
Yeah, same.
Rather than news itself. But also some of these comedy shows, like The Daily Show or John Oliver, seemingly do a better job of deep diving and dissecting things than a majority of the news programs.
I feel like this was necessary in the 90s. Because there was a lot happening that needed to be talked about and exposed. I feel like it's kind of a lazy way to get news. And also, I don't know that the things George Bush was doing in the 2000s were necessarily comedy. Like, there comes a point where you have to stop laughing about the stupid things someone says and get very serious about the things that person is doing. And George Bush was an example of that. Like, we played him up as this sort of clown in the 2000s, especially on shows like The Daily Show. And, like, he was a war criminal.
Right.
Like, he committed war crimes. And we just kind of laughed our way through it all. And I feel like what a lot of these shows did was just kind of make us feel better about what was happening as opposed to informing us in some more profound way than just watching the news would have.
And in many ways, Trump is just a more drastic version of Bush on the pendulum of swinging between, can you believe what this idiot said? This idiot looked at the sun during an eclipse. You know, where he has toilet paper on his shoe or can't fucking close an umbrella. But also just doing insanely damaging things, dismantling our democracy and our social political norms.
Yeah, it becomes a matter of yeah, they're criticizing Trump, and they're definitely on the right side in that way. But it's sometimes more a matter of the things they're not talking about. The way you see Trump covered, especially when it comes to comedy now, it's not in any critical sort of way. You're not going to learn anything new about Trump by watching any of these comedy news shows. Mm-hmm. You're going to see Trump's wackiest moments played up for comedic value. And I'm sorry, this is not the time. Like, this is not the time for that. Like, everyone should be gravely concerned every time they talk about Trump.
And the coverage is kind of like a magician. Like, watch the busy hand, and no one's seeing, like, the hand, the other hand that's doing the actual trick. Like, he says, oh, maybe we'll buy Greenland, and everyone talks about that instead of the nine other actually bad things that are happening.
It's a thing that extends beyond comedy news now. Like, even with the regular news, I think I said this on a Cracked podcast before, too, but, like, when all of the Russia investigation stuff was first coming out, if there was a day where the media really picked up on that story, if you looked around in the news, there was probably something else crazy happening that we maybe should have also been talking about.
Is it something with how the comedy shows tend to cover stuff, too? Because, like, especially, I feel like Jon Stewart is known to people as a landmark of this stuff, but Bill Maher was before him, and it's almost a format where, like, on a news show, you, especially before these guys, kind of had to talk about all this stuff and just keep talking about it until you'd explained it. And on Bill Maher's show, it was like, at last, a comedian and his friends are here to do just a discussion, and there'll be some bits. And, like the end point can be figuring it out, or the end point can be bits, and who knows what we'll get to. It's just kind of a looser approach.
Well, I think it gets blurred when you, it's not just comedian friends, you're intermixing that with having presidential candidates on your show. Right. And you know, every week now Bill Maher has a senator or somebody from the CDC or some high profile person. And then you see that person on, you know, CNN or Fox too. And I think CNN and Fox start to take little pieces from The Daily Show or Bill Maher and try to become more entertaining for ratings rather than be straight objective news.
I will say that I think Bill Maher is probably the best format for this because at least it's a discussion and it's not just one viewpoint, which gets to be very controversial from time to time. That's why there's always scandals about things Bill Maher said or something one of his guests said on a show, because it's a little more freewheeling of an environment as opposed to something that's just tightly scripted like The Daily Show.
Plus, it's live, so a lot of times accidents happen or people say things that they can't edit out or backtrack.
Yeah.
That overall mindset, like you said, Chet, the Bill Maher show Politically Incorrect starts 93. Jon Stewart takes over The Daily Show 99. And then at the same time, in 1999, Brian Williams, the NBC anchor, is doing skits at the White House Correspondent Dinner. And then the following decade, he hosts SNL, even though he thought before that it would mess up all his credibility.
Yeah, that's what's going to mess up his credibility.
And then later invents stories about Iraq. But it seems like it is really that first decade of news people feeling like they need to be funny and comedy people feeling like they need to be the news. And then eventually it just becomes everyone talking. And that's harder to parse, and it's harder to track, like, what's important and who's right and everything else.
I mean, at the correspondence dinners, you literally had Obama doing 10 minutes of stand-up. Obviously, other people are writing it for him. I remember watching a couple of those and being impressed at how fucking good he was.
Yeah.
But that's not the role of a president. You shouldn't have to put any thought or worry into, like, well, I got to perform for the correspondence tonight.
Right. As we kind of wrap things up, like, that's just a few of many elements of the 90s that are still with us. But especially, are the 90s so prominent with us because so many people either grew up in them or were young people then and are now at, like, that in their 50s or 60s authority figure age, you know? Like, it seems like that decade's going to stay dominant for a while just in our whole culture.
Well, it's such a transitional decade. It's the only decade that we have pre- and post-internet. And really, to a large extent, pre- and post-widely available home computers.
I feel like I can pinpoint exactly why the 90s seemed so chill. and why they actually sucked.
Ooh.
And it comes down to one basic thing. We didn't have an enemy in the 90s. The Cold War was over, so we couldn't spend our military dollars on fighting communism. Boris Yeltsin was still in charge in Russia, and under Yeltsin, they like became a more open and transparent society for a while. And like it felt chill because we didn't have that like specter of the ever-present threat of death hanging over us. I'm old enough to have grown up in the 80s. And I remember there was a while there, like 84, 85, where all the news was just, we are going to die in a nuclear war soon. You don't even know. We are all going to go get in your fucking basement right now. And then the 90s hit and my school converted our bomb shelter to an arcade room. And like we weren't fighting Russia anymore. And it was just like, oh man, isn't peace great? And meanwhile, the government was like, fuck peace. We need to fight someone soon. And I feel like we spent the 90s looking for somewhere to direct our military aggression. And that's why it simultaneously seemed chill and was also one of the worst decades in American history. Because the things we did to suss out an enemy to fight in the 2000s were brutal.
Because also the 90s were full of like military interventions, like the first Gulf War, and we were in Bosnia and we were in Kosovo, and Somalia was a thing. Like there were all kinds of conflicts, but just none of them were the 20-year wars that like filled the past two decades.
Yeah, so we also cared about them a little less and, you know, paid less attention to them. And I think a lot of those wars were us going, all right, who are we going to fight next? We got to figure this out. We have all these tanks. They aren't going to drive themselves. Because that's how we make money in this country. We make so much money off the military. And we were just floundering for a way to spend it in the 90s. And a lot of people got hurt in the process.
Yeah. Well, at least this decade's going great. All right.
Can't complain about the 2020s at all. So nice.
I don't know if you guys have been watching the news, but things are actually not going that well right now. We're in the middle of a worldwide pandemic.
Oh, Chad, always coming in with some kind of thing to spoil my vibe. Ugh, jeez. Folks, that is the episode for this week. My thanks to Adam Todd Brown and Chet Wild for broadcasting about the 1990s in a 2020 fashion. Wow, decades are crazy. And in our footnotes, you will find all of the sources about that crazy decade, the 1990s, that we drew on today. In particular, a Vice article that has the weird AOL CDs that were oddly collectible and promoting other products like Spider-Man and Omaha Steaks. Also, the 1994 crime bill we talked about, the early internet rise of extremism we talked about, the one section of the 1996 Communications Act that outlined all of how the internet works today, and so much more. And of course, you will find The 90s Sucked, which is a show on the Unpopular Opinion Podcast Network, hosted by my guests, Adam Todd Brown, Chet Wild. It's great, and I highly recommend it. Check it out. Also, if you recognize Chet's voice from my podcast miniseries, One Way to Make an Emoji, that is because he is the comedian from Greater Buffalo, New York, who contributed to that, so you can hear Chet there as well. And beyond all that, our theme music is Chicago Falcon by the Budos Band. This episode was engineered by me in Durham, North Carolina, and by Adam Todd Brown and Chet Wild in separate Southern California locations. Then it was edited by Chris Souza in a whole nother location because we're being socially distant. It's the thing to do. If you love this episode, that's great. Please leave us a positive 5-star review on the platform of your choice, in particular Apple Podcasts, because that means the algorithms on podcast platforms will tell people that the show is out there, and then I think that's a good thing. This week's 5-star reviewer we're featuring is an Apple user called SuperPassion101, which is maybe my favorite. Like, that's a very AOL chat sort of screen name, SuperPassion101, way into it. And they say, quote, "Relief for my brain. I am not intelligent enough to convey all these thoughts myself. Every time I listen to your podcast, I feel like it's scratching an itch I couldn't reach." End quote. Which is an incredibly nice thing to say, Super Passion. Thank you so much. And then counterfactual for you people, let's say you hated this show. Well, then let me know about it on social media. That's right, social media. A thing that the 1990s pretty much lacked. We had a past episode with Gretchen McCullough, who's an internet linguist, where we talked about generations of the internet. And something that came up is that there were sort of Usenet forums and message boards for people before social media. So that was social, right? Getting to talk about evil things or Star Trek or Oasis, like we said on the show. That was the thing then. Here in 2020, when we have so many more things, my Twitter account is at Alex Schmitty. My Instagram is at Alex Schmitztagram, and I'm on the wider internet at my website, alexschmitty.com. And I'm here to say we will be back next week with more Cracked Podcast. So how about that? Talk to you then.